time is 9:04, and this is the Senate State Affairs Committee. Today's date is April 7th, 2011. We have with us Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer, Senator Passman, myself, Wilkowski. We have three items on the agenda today. First is Senate Bill 117, which would provide PFDs on an ongoing basis to long-term Alaskans serving in the military. HCR 7, which would award the Alaska Decoration of Honor to certain members of the military, and House Bill 3, which would authorize the DMV to issue driver's licenses for less than 5 years. Please note that I am changing the order of our agenda slightly to accommodate some of our presenters' schedules. First up is Senate Bill 117. This bill would enable Alaskans who join the military and then are deployed out of state to continue to receive their permanent fund dividend checks while serving in the armed forces. Currently, long-term Alaskans who enlist with every intention of returning to Alaska after serving are denied their PFDs after 10 years. I am the sponsor of this bill. Here to present the bill on my behalf is Michael Caulfield from my office. Michael, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and provide a brief overview. I guess before you do that, we have a CS / version M, and if I could get a motion to adopt that and for discussion purposes.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we bring the CS for the bill / M version for us.
Thank you, and I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Michael, if you could give us a brief overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Caulfield. I'm a staffer in Senator Wilkowski's office, and I'd like to thank the State Affairs Committee for hearing as Senate Bill 117.
You're welcome.
As any Alaskan knows, one of the great benefits of living in the state is the yearly PFD payment. Most would agree that the PFD should not be withheld from those with a legitimate reason to be gone from the state with every intention to come back. Thus, the state smartly has exemptions for residents absent for reasons like school, medical treatment, or military service. These exemptions have a sunset date of 10 years, as most people gone from that long clearly do not intend to return to Alaska. However, some jobs may require people to be gone from the state for longer than those 10 years. One of them is congressional service. Our delegation in D.C. cannot live at home, so statutes allow for them to receive PFDs past those 10-year limits. Another job where Alaskans may not be able to return home for long periods of time is the military. Members of the armed forces can't choose to where to be stationed, and if they make a career of the military, they may be gone for over 10 years. These brave men and women make great sacrifices to protect us all, and the least we can do is to ensure they still receive their PFDs. Senate Bill 117 will provide an exemption for Alaskan soldiers who are gone for over 10 years will still get their PFDs, just like our congressional delegation. And then to quickly go over the changes in the CS, they're both on the second page. Lines 1 through 5 require that the soldier receiving the PFD was actually in the state for the time required to traditionally get the PFD without an exemption for the 3 years prior to getting the before joining the military, unless they were gone for education purposes. And then the second section is lines 6 through 11, which provides a severability clause in case this were to be held invalid. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And just before questions are asked, I know I suspect there probably will be some questions on the constitutionality, and there is a legal opinion in your files. We do have legislative counsel here to answer questions on that if members do have questions. Any questions for Michael? Okay, seeing none, thank you for the presentation. Okay, we have a couple members of the administration here. Ms. Bitney is here. If you could come up, and we may have some questions for you. I know you probably don't have testimony, but I'll just see if the members have questions for you. If you could put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Debbie Bitney. I'm the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Good morning. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And am I right that you don't have testimony? You're just
correct.
For questions?
Okay. I'm just here for questions.
Thank you. I guess let me start out and ask you, this started, I've actually had several constituents ask me about, who've told me that they've had problems with this, either spouses or sons or daughters have gone off to the military, been deployed for long periods of time, and then had problems getting their permanent fund dividend checks. And Can you talk a little bit about the magnitude of the problem? Is this a problem that you're seeing in the permanent fund division?
Senator Wilikowski, Chair, I can only tell you that while we have applied the law as it is currently written, that we have had complaints from people who were, you know, denied their dividend for this reason, for the tenure reason.
And let me welcome Senator Kukesh to the committee. Senator, we just started a few minutes ago. We're on Senate Bill 117. Thank you. Just had an overview. In terms of the magnitude of the complaints, is it 10? Is it 50? Is it 100? Is it 1,000? Do you have a sense?
I would say that it's less than 30, maybe even less than 20. But the people that we do hear from are extremely loud. And they talk to everybody.
Okay. Are other questions for Ms. Bitney? Okay. Yeah, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Debbie, are most of the complaints related around military service? What are the predominant reasons, would you say?
Through the chair, Representative Senator Giesel, sorry. Yes, I believe that most all of the complaints that I have heard are from military members. Most of the people who are out of the state for that length of time tend to be military. Usually students. I can't recall any students that were out the 10 years that were affected by this rule at the time.
So. Yeah, please follow up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you aware of any information about folks in the military who have been absent more than 10 years and then actually do return and become permanent residents of Alaska? Is that anything you could track?
Through the chair, we're attempting now to do that kind of research to figure it out. It's not a simple query. Obviously, it's a complicated process to come up with this. We have done some research, and my initial findings were that 78 people currently, this year, reside in Alaska. And at some point since 1990 had 10 years of absences or more, and at least one of those years was for military purposes. So, you know, being any more specific than that takes a lot more research.
Okay, other questions for Ms. Bitney? Can you talk about I guess we'll come back. Are you available to stay in case questions arise?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, why don't we do that? We also have Chris, is it Pogge in the room from the Department of Law? Yeah, and if you could come forward and maybe give us, put yourself on the record and give us your perspective on the constitutional issues that arise from this. We appreciate it.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Chris Pogge. I work for the Department of Law. I'm lucky to provide legal services for Debbie Bitney, Permanent Fund Dividend Division, for about 7 years now. I don't think it's any surprise. I haven't seen the legal opinion drafted by Life's Legal, but that there is a specter or concern regarding the constitutionality of the bill, only because we sort of know through the Zobel case and a case after that called Sands v. Roe that when you take a class of residents and you take a class and break them into new residents and long-term residents, that sort of bifurcation of equally qualified residents creates a risk of unequal protection or right to travel challenge. The most recent case that I can talk about was Sands v. Roe. It was a U.S. Supreme Court decision. It didn't involve the dividend like the Zobel case did. It involved welfare benefits that were available to California residents. And what they did is they said new California residents, even though they were residents, for the first year that you're in California, you'll receive welfare benefits that were from the state you came from, whereas the long-term California residents would receive the higher level of welfare benefits. And the court universally said that that was unconstitutional to create classes of residents and distribute benefits unequally. Arguably, an argument can be made that this bill is doing something along those lines. I think to sort of talk about this bill a little bit, we should probably talk about the basis of the PFD allowable absences, which I assume you folks all know, but just to make sure we're on the same page. To qualify for a dividend, you need to be in Alaska with an intent to remain, or if you're absent from Alaska, you have to have an intent to return. We have a general rule. After you get over the hurdle of the initial residency period, which we know is a longer period of time for other PFD purposes, once you get over that initial hurdle, you and I were all allowed to leave the state for up to 180 days so long as we maintain an intent to return. So in other words, our absence isn't inconsistent with our intent to return. The legislature over the years has looked at and approved, I think there are 16 now, special exceptions that will allow for absences in excess of that 180 days because the legislature has decided that those categories of absences are also not inconsistent with their intent to return to Alaska, even though their departure from the state is for a period of in excess of the 180 days. I think around the year 1998, the legislature started to decide that, well, there has to be a limit because the longer an individual is gone from the state on one of these long-term allowable absences for up to the entire year, the less likely it is that they are to return. So the legislature imposed a 10-year hard cap. After 10 years of allowable absences, I guess the legislature decided it was unlikely that they were going to return. However, in doing so, it created an exemption for members of Congress and their staff and their spouses. I can't glean from the legislative intent exactly what that was, but we've, in cases, we've picked up, and we think that it's because members of Congress are obviously required to maintain state residence. They maintain routine and frequent visits back to Alaska that are public and visible, and we can see their presence. And after 10 years of service for the state of Alaska or longer, we think obviously the legislature decided this category of folks was likely to return. So we think that exemption from the 10-year rule for members of Congress was a decision by the legislature that that category was likely to return. Now, this bill sort of creates another exemption, but it splits the military allowable absences into two classes, a subclass of, I don't know how to call them other than long-term Alaska residents and the newer, shorter-term Alaska residents. But because it creates that class based on residency, there is a risk that the military folks who are the newer-term residents would bring a challenge similar to Zobel or similar to the one I mentioned in Sandsby Row. So it has that specter of potential constitutionality to it, unconstitutionality to it. We believe that the goal here or the recognition of the legislature is that not that we want to specially treat this class of residents because their service is honorable. That's obviously something that's true for all military folks. But because the belief of the legislature is that this category of folks is more likely to return to the state, much like members of legislature who were exempted from the 10-year rule. So we think that's the goal, and we would be glad to defend that lawsuit if it comes. At this point, as Ms. Bitney pointed out, we don't have statistics that would help support hard and fast rules that would support that. We would argue that obviously common sense supports that position, and that's what the legislative record hopefully will reflect. But we don't have statistics to support it. There is that risk of a challenge. We'll defend it to the best of our ability. I think the precaution that we recommended to the House side was that if there is a constitutional challenge and if this exemption is found suspect or unconstitutional, that the legislature make clear that you don't want the 10-year rule to go away, that you just want the exemption to go away, so that it's clear that the exemption is severed from the bill rather than the 10-year rule itself being found unconstitutional. Great. Is there any questions?
Excellent analysis. Thank you. Questions? I don't see any. If you could stay for a few more minutes, we'd appreciate it in case any do. I do want to go to public testimony because I know we have some people, at least one person calling in from very far away. And the first person signed up is Tico. It's I think it's spelled wrong here, but I believe it's Tico Crowfoot. Tico, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Thanks very much.
Thank you for calling in. I believe you're overseas now. Is that correct?
I'm still stateside right now, sir, but I'm heading overseas in a couple months here.
Great. Thank you. Well, I appreciate you calling in. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Tico Crowfoot. I'm currently an active duty lieutenant commander in the Navy SEAL teams. I have been an Alaska resident since I was 4 years old. In 1997, I left Alaska to attend the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. After graduation, I went through BUDS in Coronado, California, and have been an active duty SEAL for the past 10 years. I recently completed my fourth deployment to CENTCOM, which was three deployments to Iraq and one to Afghanistan, and I'm getting ready for another deployment, this time again to Afghanistan. 2 years ago, and for the first time since I was 4 years old, I was denied my permanent fund dividend. I was also denied my dividend the following year and was just denied for this year as well. And all three denials were due to Alaska Statute 43.23.008C, which says that any resident of Alaska who has not been in the state for at least 180 days of the calendar year in the last 10 years, regardless of the reason, is ineligible for the dividend. Military service members are not exempted from this despite multiple deployments overseas and being stationed in foreign countries. In fact, the only exemptions, as was previously alluded to, are for members of Congress, their families, and their staff. And if I could just say this, I absolutely believe that our elected representatives serve Alaska, this country, and I do believe that their exemption is justified and rightful. The issue I have, though, is that I also believe that Alaska service members and their family are no less deserving of the exemption afforded to the members of Congress. In the hope of convincing the members of the legislature that the PFD, as it currently stands, does penalize the Alaska service members who intend to return to Alaska, I'm going to give you guys a little background on myself so you understand the type of person who is being disqualified by the current statute. I grew up in Alaska, as I said, since I was 4 years old in 1983. I'm currently 32, and I have an unbroken Alaskan residency for 28 years. I'm an Alaskan registered voter, and I've voted in all Alaska elections. I have an Alaska's driver's license, and it's the only driver's license I've ever had, so I've never had a driver's license outside of the state of Alaska. Alaska is listed as my home of record with the military, which means they expect me to return to Alaska and will pay for me and for my family to do so once my service is complete. They will not pay for me to return to any other state, so this is what the military considers my home, as I do. Every job I've ever held, excluding this current military service, has been in Alaska. Every school I've ever attended, other than the Naval Academy, has also been in Alaska. Both my mother and my father have been Alaskan residents since 1974, and they are currently Alaskan residents. I own property in Alaska just outside Denali National Park. I am also part owner in my family's business, which is also just outside Denali National Park. I received the permanent fund dividend every year I lived in Alaska since I was 4 years old, which clearly illustrates that I was meeting all PFD requirements for eligibility prior to my military service. I also received the PFD for the first 10 years of my military service, illustrating that I met the PFD requirements, including the 72-hour and 5-year rules. In every aspect, I met and continue to meet all eligibility requirements for the PFD, even while serving in the military. In short, the only thing that is precluding me from continuing to receive the PFD is this 10-year statute. I believe that military members deserve the dividend, even if they are stationed outside the state while serving their country. I truly believe there are ways to exempt individuals from the 10-year statute and fairly qualify people who do intend on making Alaska their home once their service has ended. Even with my 10 years of service, as I mentioned, I have made a trip to Alaska at least once a year during my leave periods. I was a resident when I entered the military. I have always voted in Alaska elections. I hold an Alaska driver's license. I own property in the state, and I have it listed as my home of record with the military. I would hope that one or some combination of these qualifiers distinguishes a sincere desire to return to the state from a disingenuous attempt at permanent fund eligibility. I've heard people say that military members are trying to milk the system, and I think this has been talked to quite extensively throughout the House and also with the Senate. And they're trying to milk the system possibly by trying to receive the dividend, even though they've only been in Alaska for a little time and then have left the state. The irony in this for me is that it actually cost me more to fly back to Alaska to establish my residency and my intent to return to Alaska than I ever received from the permanent fund dividend. The reason I returned to Alaska is not for the PFD, but because I consider it my home, and I truly intend to retire there when I leave the service. I know each and every one of you is extremely busy, but I would very much appreciate your help in changing this law so that it would support our career military members rather than penalize them. I believe, honestly, that you would have tremendous support from your constituents on this issue, and from the people with whom I've spoken, they absolutely corroborate this. And I think, more importantly, you'd be doing the right thing for those of us who decide to serve this country in this capacity. I want to thank all of you very much for your time and for this opportunity to speak with you. I very much appreciate any decision you guys make and the time listening to me. Thank you all very much.
Tico, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your service to our country. You're the reason, you're a big reason why we brought this bill forward, and thank you for your activism and for bringing it to our attention. Are there questions by the committee? Senator Passman.
When do you expect to retire from the military?
I can retire at the 20-year mark, sir. That is the point at which you could first retire from the military. I will retire from the military when it is no longer a challenge and no longer something that I enjoy doing. Whenever that is, though, regardless of whether or not it is a 20-year mark or later on, my intent has always been to return to Alaska and reside there. And I have a home there which I plan to go back to. I visit every year. So I truly believe that the aspects of my life show very clear that Alaska is near and dear to my heart and that it is my home. So I can't answer that question. I apologize for that. I do not know when I will retire. I have military commitments that make it so that I could not absolutely say that I'll retire at the 20-year mark. But regardless of whether or not it's 20 or 25 or 30 or more, wherever I end up, whenever I finish up this military service, it will be in Alaska.
Other questions? Okay, Tico, thank you again for your testimony. Okay, let's move on. We have one other person signed up to testify. That's Tracy Ross. Actually, we have a couple other
people. Hello there.
And we have Rick Davidge. So, Tracy, if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record, give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. My name is Tracy Ross, and I'm calling on behalf of my husband, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Ross. We are currently stationed in Okinawa, Japan, where I am calling you at 3 a.m. on Friday, April 8th. Brian wanted his voice heard in full support of Senate Bill 117, but he is currently deployed to the Philippines and unable to call in to testify. Thank you for allowing me to do so on his behalf. Please consider my husband's life story as you debate whether some Alaskan residents who are career military deserve equal protection under the law and be allowed to continue to receive a PFD despite their extended absence. Brian was born in Anchorage, Alaska in 1972 and attended grades kindergarten through 12 in Anchorage. He left Alaska in 1990 to attend the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, having been nominated by former Senator Frank Murkowski and current Congressman Don Young. In 1994, he was commissioned a United States Marine Corps second lieutenant. For the last 18 years, he has served our country around the world, including 6 overseas deployments. He served in combat on 2 deployments to Iraq. Brian is proud to have received the first PFD given to Alaskans in 1982 at age 10. How many of you remember getting that first $1,000 check? He does. I think he even has a picture around here somewhere of him with it. He has possessed a valid Alaska driver's license continuously since 1988 when he turned 16. He has been registered to vote in Alaska since turning 18 in 1990. He and I both voted in Alaska by absentee ballot in the most recent elections in 2010. Brian has titled, registered, and licensed every vehicle he has owned in Alaska since his first truck in 1992, proudly displaying his Alaska license plates all over the lower 48. Brian's last will and testament designates his residency in Alaska and upon his death will be executed in the state of Alaska. In addition to these continuous and extensive paper ties, he has significant physical ties as well. Brian's parents and 2 brothers live in Alaska and have lived there for 40 years. Since 1999, we have owned several cabins and 5 acres of land near Glen Allen. Brian, our 3 kids, and I most recently visited our property during our visit to Alaska last June. Brian and I have made dozens of trips back to Alaska, totaling over 80 days in the last 5 years alone. It has been very expensive to do so, and we have certainly spent our fair share of PFDs just getting back to the state, but all of us love going home during Brian's precious time off. We were just in Alaska in December, having taken an Air Force cargo plane for 9 hours across the Pacific. Call us crazy for taking our family on such a trek, but it was well worth it to get home for the holidays. Imagine Brian's surprise then, despite being an Alaskan resident for the previous 36 years and a recipient of PFDs for 26 years, when he was denied a PFD in 2008 because of Alaska Statute 43.23.008C. Nothing in his status had changed other than the state decided on an arbitrary 10-year cap. After losing an informal and formal appeal through the PFD appeals process, Brian has chosen to take the state of Alaska to court and file a superior court judicial review as allowed under Alaska statutes. Marines never surrender, so Brian applied for a 2010 dividend and was denied for a second year. Ironically, he filed his informal appeal for the 2010 dividend while we were all in Alaska 3 months ago for Christmas. And Brian filed for his 2011 dividend before the 31 March deadline and before he deployed to the Philippines. If nothing else, Brian insists he will keep the state very busy in handling his yearly applications and appeals. So I ask you, is Brian less deserving of a PFD because he has chosen a military career which exceeds an arbitrary 10 years but meets and exceeds all other PFD division requirements? If Brian is not an Alaskan resident, then where do you suggest is his home? What is his state of residence? After being married to him for over 15 years, I can tell you the answer to those questions. It is without a doubt Alaska. Finally, and the most important point, is that a military service member's home of record and state of legal residence is, by federal law, the state the federal government expects him or her to return home to and will pay for him or her to return home to upon the completion of the service member's career. Brian's home of record legal residence was established as Alaska upon his enlistment into the military and has never changed in 20 years and is part of the federal record. Many service members in their careers change their home of record and state residency to take advantage of resident state taxes, in-state college tuition, and other benefits. In 20 years of military service, Brian has never changed his home of record or residency from Alaska, nor has he taken advantage of or benefited from claiming residency in any other state. Despite living in six states, and now one foreign country, he has had paper and physical ties to only Alaska. The only reason our family does not live in Alaska now is because Brian chose a career in the U.S. Marine Corps that began 8 years before Alaska Statute 43.23.008C even became law. Upon his retirement from the service, he intends to return all of us to Alaska to live permanently and has sworn to that fact on every PFD application for the past 20 years since joining the military. So please pass Senate Bill 117 to allow lifetime Alaskans and career military personnel like Brian to continue to receive his PFDs. It's the right thing to do. Lastly, Brian asks that you backdate it to the 2009 PFD. He was a little upset after being told by a form letter that he wasn't an Alaskan resident that year, despite being one for the previous 36 years. Thank you for listening.
Tracy, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions. We also have Rick Davidge signed up to testify. Rick, are you there?
Chairman, can you hear me?
If you could get a little bit closer to your phone. We're trying to work with the sound here. Yeah, Rick, put yourself on the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Davidge. I hold a number of leadership positions in veterans organizations in the state of Alaska, as well as national chairman of a number of veterans committees. As you know, Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Veterans Political Action Committee and the Alaska Veterans Foundation and Vietnam Veterans of America have been asking for some changes to the PFD status, particularly dealing with the 10-year rule and secondarily with the 72-hour rule because of the cost involved in service members having to return to maintain their dividend status. I think both of the members of the service who have testified prior to me have given Ms. Bitney some specific indications of intent to return, and Deborah and I have talked about some of these in the past, but maybe we should, in the regulatory process, have her take a look at some of those indications, because I think both of these witnesses who we've been working with since the legislature started have are excellent examples of Alaskans who are Alaskans prior to service and certainly intend to be Alaskans upon return. The bottom line thing for me, excuse me, having been a service member as well as a staffer for Senator Ted Stevens, when I look at those two exemptions, I have to tell you my service in the military is of higher value. No disrespect to my former boss. But I think the bottom line for me is if we're going to exempt members of Congress, their staffs and spouses, we should at least recognize the service and the commitment of these fine gentlemen to our state, and they will be a benefit to our state upon return. I have absolutely no question in my mind that both Tico and Colonel Ross will return to the state. As you know, my son spent 4 years active duty in Iraq as well as 8 years service. He and I spent a great deal of time dealing with the problems of maintaining his PFD, and a number of times had to assist him and his family to come back to Alaska to maintain his 72-hour requirement. So there are, and he is back in Alaska attending University of Alaska Anchorage at this time. So I'd ask the committee to look at these two gentlemen as an example of great Alaskans and great American heroes who have made a commitment to come back to Alaska, and we certainly should recognize that commitment and their service by exempting them from the 10-year rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you for your advocacy on this and other issues. I don't see any questions. Other members online wanting to testify? Okay, hearing none. Let's go. We have Lisa Kirsch here as well. Lisa, if you could come forward and put yourself on the record. Thank you for attending.
My name is Lisa Kirsch. I'm an attorney at Legislative Legal and have been asked to come in and answer questions today.
Thank you. We appreciate it. You heard counsel for the state talk a little bit about their view of the bill and this issue. Could you talk a little bit about your legal analysis, your perspective on this issue and the bill in particular?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that I can really add too much to what Mr. Pogue had to say. I think, you know, he's been litigating these issues and is, you know, well-versed in the ins and outs. I think, you know, he correctly identified the crux of the problem, which is the three-year residency requirement within the bill, which does, you know, split these military members who have been out of the state getting an allowable absence for 10 years into two groups. One that has the 3 years, you know, prior receipt of dividends, which really means 4 years of residency in the state before they enter the military. So that does create a little bit of a problem in terms of equal protection, because you are treating two groups disparately. And I think that's an accurate analysis of the primary source of a problem, that, you know, they're either under equal protection or under the federal right to travel.
Okay, thank you for that. Other questions by the committee? Okay, well, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Not at this time.
Is there, my intent is not to move the bill today. I want to try to work through these constitutional issues and try to get a bill that that could withstand some legal challenge. I think there was some very compelling testimony, and I think maybe we can look towards either home of record or maybe some other indicators that that these members plan on coming back to Alaska as maybe a way that to tie their eligibility. Have you looked into that, or do you have any idea whether that would be constitutional?
I believe that some of those indicators of residency are already part of existing law. So
I see Ms. Bitney shaking her head. Yes. Okay. Okay. If there's no other questions, then thank you. Actually, Senator Geisel has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if the question is for Ms. Kirsch or Director Bitney, but I'll pose it and whoever wants to answer it. So if an individual who is a member of the military is deemed a resident and we make this exception, does that automatically then make their offspring, that is their children, also eligible for a PFD because the parent is considered a resident?
Now, that one I may defer to Ms. Bitney on, because I know there has been some, I believe there was a change in that area.
Yes. Through the chair, Debbie Bitney, Director for Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Yes, the children, if the military member is the sponsor for the children, then they will qualify. Yes.
And then while we have you here, we were shaking your head about the home of record issue, and maybe you can talk just a minute about how you look at that when you're analyzing whether or not to allow a permanent fund dividend.
We have, I believe it's a regulation in place now that requires any declaration of residency in payroll records, if it's declared anywhere else other than Alaska, they're automatically disqualified because you're not able to claim residency ties to any other state or country. So it already.
Senator Passman.
Has there been any constitutional analysis that if the exemption was established for a military person, that, for example, an Alaska resident, 3 years of receiving the dividend, goes to work for a private company, as a result of the private company business decisions, they say we're going to station you overseas or anywhere out of Alaska for 20 years, and they say, look, I intend to come back no different than the military. Has there been any analysis of that?
If through the chair, Senator Pascan, if I understand your question, it would not be considered an allowable absence because it's for private employment purposes. So that would not, they would never qualify for a dividend if they were out of the state more than 180 days in a year anyway.
Senator Kukesh.
I just want to follow up on that. But the distinction would be then in the military you're told where you have to go. In the private practice you have a choice of whether accepting that or not and go and look for another job. The military doesn't have that easy out.
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, that is essentially correct.
That's just my thinking. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, both of you. Do we have anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Okay, seeing none, we're going to close public testimony for now. And we're going to set the bill aside. I do want to try to work through these constitutional issues and try to get a product that can withstand legal challenge. So we'll set the bill aside. Thank you all for that good hearing. Let's move on now to House Concurrent Resolution Number 7, which would award the Alaska Decoration of Honor to certain members of the military. The Decoration of Honor Program Award was created in 2007 to honor Alaskans who have made the ultimate sacrifice and lost their lives while serving the nation. In 2009, the Joint Armed Services Committee organized a major ceremony in Anchorage to recognize more than 170 Alaskans who since statehood have been killed while serving in the armed forces. It was an honor to be a part of that ceremony. I want to thank Representative Sadler for bringing forward this year's resolution listing the names of the men and women who we owe this great respect and gratitude to. Unfortunately, we have a number of Alaskans who've lost their lives just in a short recent years. So welcome to the committee, Representative Sadler. If you could put yourself on the record, give us a brief overview of House Concurrent Resolution Number 7.
Thank you, Chairman Blakowski. Members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, for the record, Representative Dan Sadler for House District 18. And you've taken much of my introductory remarks, Mr. Chairman. I'm here today to ask for your support for House Concurrent Resolution 7. HCR 7 awards the Alaska Decoration of Honor to 30 military service members killed in the line of duty between January 1, 2009 and February 15, 2011. The legislature created the Alaska Decoration of Honor in 2007 by House Bill 244. It's a medal, and a sample is being passed among you now, awarded posthumously to military service members either from Alaska or deployed while stationed in Alaska who were killed in action or in support of combat action. The medal is presented to the families of these service members. Now, the legislature must authorize the award by resolution and has done so in the past with SCR 18 in 2008, sponsored by yourself, sir, and by HCR 7 in 2009. To date, a total of 177 individuals have been awarded the Alaska Decoration of Honor dating back to service at statehood. HCR 7 will award another 30 service members with the Alaska Decoration of Honor and authorize their families to receive this decoration on behalf of their loved ones sacrificed to our state and country. While it is my hope and prayer that we never have to award this medal again, we do know that freedom is not free. The cost is borne by men and women who risk and sometimes lose their lives in service. It's our sacred duty to remember and honor their sacrifice, and HCR 7 is one additional way to do that. I appreciate your time. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Questions for the sponsor? Okay, seeing none. Go to public testimony. Do we have anyone signed up? Seeing none. Do we have anyone in the room signed up? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. And just if you could briefly, you conferred with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to get these names. Is that where the list came from?
The chair, yes, sir. We get it from Military and Veterans Affairs. Gives us the list of names who are in their eyes eligible for this.
Double check, triple check the spellings, and feel confident.
As an old copy editor, sir, yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Any other final closing words?
No, I appreciate your role to support this, sir. And I look forward to doing these, and I hope they're the last ones we have to do.
I agree. We typically do hold bills and resolutions for a hearing. This, I think, in recent days we've been moving some of the easier ones just in the interest of time, and I don't think there's any concerns with this. I certainly don't. I'm co-sponsor, the cross-sponsor. So if there's if there is no concerns, then I'm happy to take a motion if the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee move House Concurrent Resolution number 7, version backslash A, from this committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Any? Seeing none, okay. Resolution is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Representative Sadler. Okay, let's take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. We have the final bill today is House Bill 3 by Representative Lynn. This bill would enable the Department of Motor Vehicles to issue driver's licenses for less than the normal 5 years to certain individuals. Here to represent the bill is Representative Lynn and his aide, Thomas Riker. Representative Lynn, welcome to the committee. If you could give us a brief overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for excuse me, for hearing this bill today. I apologize for being late. You have a bill in my State Affairs Committee, and I have a bill in your State Affairs Committee. That's the way it happens at this time of the year.
You are attending to very important things.
By happenstance, Mr. Chairman and Committee, this bill you're hearing today concerning driver's licenses has the same bill number, HB3, as proposed legislation that was considered in the House State Affairs and on the House floor last year. But the bills are very, very different. It's not your mother's Oldsmobile, in other words. For one thing, HB3 before you today consists of a one-paragraph section and one page, while last session's iteration of HB3 ran 5 pages and 9 sections. The bill today cuts directly to the chase, which is this. Under current statute, Alaska driver's licenses are issued for a period of 5 years from your birth date. That's a reasonable and satisfactory period, a time for American citizens, and nothing in this bill changes that whatsoever. Now, HB3 deals only with those who are not citizens. Basically, they're visiting Alaska. They're visitors, not immigrants. Today, a non-citizen can be legally in the United States with a passport or a visa or a green card or whatever, a note from your mother, whatever, that expires tomorrow, but then go down to the DMV and get Alaska's driver's license that lasts for 5 years. And I hope you agree that's not a good situation. It's almost like, duh, you know. HB3 is simple. It merely permits the DMV to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years to match the term of a non-citizen visitor's legal presence document, such as a visa. In other words, if someone's visa expires in 6 months, their driver's license would expire in 6 months. Now, I think that's just plain, you know, common sense. My staffer, Thomas Riker here, will go over the language of HB3. It's rather short, like I said. And we, I hope, have Kerry Hennings from the DMV online, and Jerry Luckup, assistant reviser, will make himself available if we need his help. So I appreciate you hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Thomas, welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Thomas Riker, and I'm staff to Representative Bob Lynn. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, determining how long a foreign national can stay in the United States is the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, not the state of Alaska, and we should not be issuing legal documentation that outlasts a person's legal presence in the U.S. As Representative Lynn mentioned, HB3 puts an end to this practice by allowing DMV to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years. Under HB3, if a person has been admitted into the United States for a period of less than 5 years, their Alaska driver's license would expire on the same date that their legal presence in the U.S. expires. If a person's authorized to stay in the U.S. indefinitely, which is to say they're designated as duration of status or their status is pending, then they would renew their license every year. We wanted to draft this bill in the simplest, most straightforward way possible, so that's why we drafted it without any mention of ID cards. DMV feels they already have the statutory authority to issue ID cards for less than 5 years. However, given one provision in the statutes, they don't feel they have that same authority for driver's licenses. We also didn't want the bill to be overly burdensome on the people in question, and that's why we allow them to renew by mail and without a renewal fee up to 5 years. I think it's important to note that this does not change how people go about getting a driver's license or under what rules or regulations. The documentation requirements and the verification procedures that are currently in place would remain unchanged. Also, there's no requirement in this bill that people present immigration documentation as their proof of ID when they apply for a driver's license. However, if someone does present immigration documentation, then DMV would consider the expiration date. HB3 has 19 co-sponsors and passed the House with a vote of 32-2. We hope you'll join that body in supporting this bill, and we thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Thomas. Questions? Yes, Senator Pastrana.
As far as if a legal immigrant were to arrive in the United States, what other forms of identification would that legal immigrant be carrying with them?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, you know, we're confused on that point as well. You know, if you don't have a Social Security number when you apply for a driver's license, you have to prove why you don't have one. And in that situation, your proof would be your immigration documentation. I'm not from the U.S. That's why I don't have a Social Security number. However, we didn't want to take the step of you know, putting anything in this bill that requires those people to show that documentation. So if you did have something else, I can't conceive of what that would be, but if you did, you know, you're still allowed to use it. And again, that's how things are structured right now. So these people are already walking in with their immigration documentation as their proof of ID when they first apply for a driver's license or state-issued ID. You know, we don't change that, but if there is some other form that they could use that DMV would accept, then we didn't want to complicate that for them.
In other words, would a legal immigrant have, for example, a visa, passport, some type of, you know, recognized identification documentation available to them when they come into the country?
Through the chair, Senator Pasquin, one would assume so. If they're a legal immigrant, I mean, that is the definition of a legal immigrant, that they've gone through the immigration process and therefore have been issued authorization to be here. There's going to be some documentation of that from Immigration Services. If, however, they haven't received, you know, say, the final hard copy of their visa or whatever, you know, even a letter, any documentation from Immigration Services at all will work. So, for instance, people who get their length of stay extended while they're here, sometimes that's not reflected on their physical visa. Whatever they got from Immigration Services telling them that their length of stay had been extended would be accepted. And if they don't have anything at all, DMV will pick up the phone, call their contact at Homeland Security, and verify that they're allowed to be here legally and therefore allow them to have that license for however long that period of time is. But that would be incumbent upon the applicant to bring up. DMV is not going to be verifying people's immigration status as a matter of course. But if you go in and say, look, I don't have any way to prove this, but I know that Immigration Services has legally allowed me to be here, they'll pick up the phone and call Immigration and get you some form of documentation of that.
Senator Passman.
Not at the moment. We're still struggling with the still struggling with it.
And I'll just say this has been, you know, I've had concern over the older versions of the bill, as you know, Representative Lynn. And I was a sponsor of the bill prohibiting the state from using funds for Real ID. And one of the big arguments was we don't want to turn our DMV into a de facto immigration authority. You know, the purpose of the DMV is to go out and decide whether or not people should get licenses. And so I'm wondering if we're turning our DMV into a de facto immigration authority, which is really the responsibility of the federal government.
That's why, Mr. Chairman, the bill written the way it is has nothing really about that. And actually, we're not talking about immigration here. We're talking about visitors. A passport, you're a visitor. I've used a passport. Probably everybody here has. Same with some passports are coming by visa, some are not. If you have a visa, that's for people visiting someplace. We're not talking about illegal, undocumented workers or anything like that. This doesn't. That's a whole other issue that's not covered in this bill. This bill simply says that if you a visa or whatever expires, your green card, whatever expires, in 30 days, your license expired in 30 days. If it's 5 years, it's 5 years. Whatever it is. And I might point out that in some cases, somebody might be here as a visitor or whatever, maybe some kind of an immigrant, I don't know. And it has an indefinite or indeterminate status. Well, in that case, the driver's license would be issued for 1 year. And then at the end of a year, it could be extended for another year, another up to the 5 years on the driver's license, as each of us has on our own driver's licenses. But there would be no additional fee for renewing that driver's license until 5 years expired. Then it'd be a fee after that, same as it is for us when we renew our licenses. So it takes again, this is very simple, to me at least, a simple, straightforward bill. Your driver's license expires when your visa, passport, et cetera, expires.
Okay. Senator Kukesh.
Tell me what the basis of this bill is. I mean, have you had a lot of people calling you saying we have problems and we want you to solve it by putting this bill forward? Normally, people like myself and other senators or yourself have somebody who's complaining and says there's a major problem here. Can you fix it with legislation? Tell me what that basis is.
Well, through the chair. Actually, we don't have anything like that. But the thing is, the federal government and its infinite wisdom will come forth with some kind of a document, visa, passport, and so on. And so the intent is to have our state issued driver's license match the federal document, such as a visa. And you know, there are probably some aspects of Homeland Security to that.
I'm trying to find out what prompted you to do this legislation. I don't see a problem out there. You haven't told me about one. Why do we need to do this legislation?
Well, we have, through the chair, we have probably students, you know, are here beyond the visa stage. So we need to know who's driving on our highways, who's out there driving. There's aspects of Homeland Security to this. We need to know who's driving in this state. And if we issue a driver's license or any other document, somebody like that, it needs to expire when, at the same time, that any legal presence issued by the federal government expires.
Can I follow?
Yeah, absolutely.
I understand that. Yeah. I'm trying to find out if a constituent came up to you and said, here's a problem, or if a group of people who are immigrants came up to you and said, here's a problem, or Homeland Security came to you and said, here's a problem. Did anybody in that categories at all or other categories come to you and solve this for us?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
If I could, through the chair, Senator Kukesh, there is a statutory barrier right now to DMV issuing any driver's license for anyone for anything less than 5 years. And so that I think that's some of the impetus as well, is that, you know, if they're ever going to address this in any way at all, however they would choose to address it, there's going to have to be a statutory change, because right now they're barred from giving anybody a license for less than 5 years.
Are you telling me, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, telling me that a DMV came to you and said, here's the problem, can you fix it for us?
Through the chair, I wasn't privy to those conversations, so that would be a question for Replin.
Mr. Chairman, no, the DMV did not come to me. I went to the DMV way back when, eight years ago.
You've been working on this bill a long
time.
And
every year since
then. Other questions? Yes, Senator Pasternak.
You know, I think the citizens of Alaska expect that if anyone goes to DMV, that they have to pass one test, which is a driver's test. And if the person that's in front of DMV passes a driver's test, does pass, that would seem that DMV has accomplished the function that they're supposed to accomplish to make sure that there's safe drivers on the road. Is this a different test that the applicant has to appear before DMV to pass?
Through the chair, no, sir, it's not a different test. It just simply says, you know, all driver's licenses have an expiration date. What should that expiration date be? Well, one expiration date, I guess, is if we move to a different state. Most states have a period of time in which you have to apply for a driver's license in the new state that you come to. That's a date certain, whatever it happens to be. What is it here? I don't remember. But you have, when you move to Alaska, you have a certain period of time to change your previous license to an Alaska license to be on the road legally. And this is kind of the same thing. They set an expiration date, and the expiration date should be for the period of time that you're allowed to be here. That's about it.
Through the chair, Senator Pasternak, it's a test that people already have to pass. You have to prove that you are who you say you are when you go in to apply for a driver's license or a state-issued ID card. This doesn't change anything about that. All it says is that when you hand over whatever form of proof of ID you use for that, if it is an immigration documentation, then you're expiration date would be tied, but it doesn't bar you from renewing. It doesn't even impose extra costs on you for renewing up to those 5 years. It's a situation people are already facing. You know, all we're saying is that if we're going to issue an expiration date, it should be tied to the expiration date of the identification that you present. So,
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for clarification, the state ID card issued by Division of Motor Vehicles is limited to the duration of the person's legal stay in this country. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, it's not right now. However, they don't feel there needs to be DMV does not feel there needs to be a statutory change in order to implement that. Their general policy, I believe, is to have the same rules for driver's license and state-issued IDs when it comes to things like expiration date and what you have to show in order to get it. So right now, they're not doing it for either, but they feel that they could do it for ID cards under their current regulatory authority. But because of a provision in statute that says they can't give anybody a driver's license for less than 5 years, they need a change in statute in order to change it for driver's licenses. But they could do it right now for ID cards. They're not, because they try to keep the rules the same for both.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Keeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a driver's license, is this a tool that employers use for identification when someone comes to them to apply for a job? And if that's true, is it construed to be a representation of legal presence in our country?
It's one of the de facto documents that, you know, presumably if you have an Alaska driver's license, you have a legal right to be here.
Okay. Could I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I may point out, Senator, you know, the DMV is available, but please.
So a follow-up question then. So I don't recall, but I think the Social Security number has been taken off of our Alaska ID cards. And so what on our driver's license now, I guess I should have looked at mine before I came, would identify what legal presence the person has? I mean, if there's no Social Security number, would it then be assumed by someone who is receiving this card that this person is a legal resident?
He's pulling out his license.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Geisel, I think that it could be. I mean, I don't think we can say absolutely that somebody's going to look at that and think that, but you're absolutely right that in the real world, your driver's license is a key that opens a lot of gates for you, because people just accept it as a government-issued ID and a lot of times don't ask follow-up questions. And our goal isn't even necessarily to get people to ask follow-up questions, but I believe that you are correct that, you know, employers, law enforcement, in a lot of situations are going to look at that driver's license and just take it at face value and not ask any other questions.
And I'd point out, you look at the driver's license, there's nothing on there that says you're a citizen or you're not a citizen, you're a visitor, you're not a visitor, you pull over speeding or whatever, they look at your driver. Nothing there that says anything whatsoever about citizenship or immigration status or even visitor status.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Kugesh.
But you don't expect the DMV to do that, do you? I hope you don't. I mean, that's not their job. Why would you want to have that on the driver's license?
Well, the only, through the chair, the only thing in the driver's license, other than your name, address, and so on, and some physical description, is the expiration date. But I'm saying, if I'm a cop, and I used to be a cop, by the way, you ask for somebody's driver's license, you're going to look at it, name, address, primarily thing you look at. You might look at an expiration date to see if you're driving legally, and if you're driving and the license is not expired, you presume you're driving illegally, at least insofar as the license is concerned. There's nothing on anybody's driver's license that I'm aware of that shows citizenship status. It doesn't show immigration status or anything else, other than you pass certain criteria, perhaps a driving test and so on, and you have this and it expires at a date certain.
Okay, we have a few people signed up to testify. The first is Carrie Hennings from DMV. Carrie, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
This is Carrie Hennings, a driver's licensing manager for the Division of Motor Vehicle. This bill allows the DMV to promulgate regulations to shorten the length of time the DMV issues a driver's license. There is a zero fiscal note attached to this legislation, as it would not impact the DMV's existing procedures other than to expire the license at a different time than the standard five-year period. Currently, the DMV requires an individual to provide proof of legal name, date of birth, social security number, if one exists, and residence address. For immigrants, this is typically the permanent resident card. And for our international visitors, this is usually a passport accompanied by a visa. The DMV looks at immigration documents currently, and therefore we would not be impacted. There would not be a dramatic learning curve for our DMV line staff. The DMV would now simply expire the license with a legal document expiration. I think it's important to note that DMV receives letters from United States Citizenship and Immigration Services on a regular basis, and we honor those. That policy would not change under HB3, as we would continue to honor notification from USCIS that an individual's legal stay has been extended. With that, I'm happy to try to answer any questions the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. Questions by the committee? Senator Pasfan.
Sure. This is, or what the topic that you're addressing is those that are legally in the country?
That's correct.
All right. So there is no problem with their capacity to drive that you connect in any way with their legally being in the country?
Through the chair, Senator Pasfan, no, there's not.
So if they pass the test, why wouldn't the license that they are issued be equal with anyone else's license that's being issued, if the only question is how long that they would be qualified to drive, assuming they pass the driver's test?
Senator Pasfan, through the chair, there'd be no difference in the documents whatsoever. It would just be a matter of the expiration date changing with their legal presence.
When an individual applies for a job in private practice, are they now required by federal law to receive two forms of identification?
Senator Pasfan, through the chair, I'm not sure what's required in the private sector. My assumption would be, yes, you'd want a CID. I believe the private sector needs to verify legal presence. And a driver's license is most commonly used. We sell an awful lot of driving records for employment application purposes.
And isn't it true that in addition to the driver's license that one must submit a Social Security number and or a passport?
Senator Pasfan, through the chair, yes, I believe people are supposed to verify Social Security numbers when they hire an individual.
So an employer is not misled by anyone submitting their driver's license to the private employer?
Senator Pasfan, through the chair, our driver's licenses and ID cards do not display the Social Security number. It's a part of the record, but it's not printed on the card, so that would not be an indicator for an employer of a Social Security number.
No, but in the, if I may, in the context that assuming that the current law mandates that a private employer receive more information than just a driver's license, for example, the passport or Social Security number, doesn't that lead the private employer to understand that the driver's license is not indicating a basis of whether they're a legal or illegal immigrant in the United States?
Senator Pasfan, through the chair, no, it would not be an indicator of legal presence.
Other questions? Carrie, thank you for your testimony. If you could hold on, we've only got about 20 minutes left in the hearing, and is it possible for you to stay on just in case there are other questions?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go on. Yeah, actually, Senator Pasfan has a question.
What are the numbers of illegal immigrants that you believe may be applying for driver's licenses in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Passban, we would have no idea what that number would be. Without proper documentation, we just deny the application and they leave the building. So I have no idea of numbers of the illegals in Alaska.
So getting back to Senator Kukesh's issue, I believe, is there a problem within DMV with respect to this issue?
Through the chair, Senator Passban, no. As I said, if they don't have proper documentation, statutorily, we cannot issue a driver's license or an ID card.
Carrie, do you have an idea of how many individuals have visas that go to DMV for less than 5 years or visas that are indefinite?
Mr. Chairman, we don't keep those types of numbers. Just through my experience of being here for a long time, you know, we're assuming about 10% possibly. We get a lot of visitors in the summer who come in and get driver's licenses so they can rent motorhomes, do activities, and then they leave from their vacation, they take those driver's licenses home, and you know, they're not a part of our numbers any longer. So, as I said, we don't have a clear figure.
If, and I'm just curious. Do you know how many of them reapply, or would be required to reapply under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, most of our visitors are here for, you know, this in the summer. I would doubt that the majority of the people coming in with passports and visas, not looking for permanent residency, would be reapplying under this bill for a renewal.
Senator Kukesh.
I want to ask you a question on the issuance of a driver's license. Why would a visitor, especially one from the United States, come to Alaska and get a driver's license? Doesn't the DMV of Alaska recognize driver's license from all over the United States, and why would they have to reapply and get an Alaska driver's license? And the question would be different for the people who are not United States citizens. Is there a difference in the law as it relates to their license? Do they have, for example, somebody from France comes over here, wants to rent a motorhome. Is there a preclusion for that individual from renting a motorhome if he doesn't have a valid United States recognized driver's license, or can a person from France rent a motorhome? I'm trying to figure out what the rationale for this bill is. And maybe I hope I ask those questions clearly enough so you can answer it. Because I seem to remember coming from Oregon with the Oregon driver's license when I was to school down there and having to surrender my license before I got a state of Alaska license. Why would people from Lower Fayette want to come up here and surrender their current license from their home state just to get an Alaska driver's license? I'm trying to figure out why we're doing this bill.
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, people from the lower 48 coming up here on vacation, they're not surrendering their licenses and switching to an Alaska license. They retain their state license and enjoy our great state. It's the people coming in from overseas that have a passport and a visa, and they may have applied for an international driver's license, which law enforcement would recognize. They may not have, and I think it's in the private business practice, they're more concerned about insurance and liability, and that's why they're asking for some documentation to legally drive in our state.
Just to follow up then, is it a requirement from an individual from the, let's forget about the United States, and we have that answered, and even if they're visitors, they don't have to get a driver's license in the state, so let's go to the nationals from outside of the country who are not citizens of America or United States, do they in fact not have their license from France or England or wherever they come from recognized in Alaska? I don't know the answer to that question, so maybe you could just enlighten me.
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, the foreign license needs to be translated in the form of an international license, which is a simple process. Some visitors do that, some do not. but current law enforcement cannot decipher the German license versus the Norwegian license, so an international license is required.
Okay, good. So if an individual from France comes over and wants to rent a motorhome and presents a French license, that person wouldn't be allowed to rent a vehicle in Alaska then?
Through the chair, Senator, that would be up to the individual rental motorhome company, you know, what their rules and business practices were.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
We've got a number of people signed up to testify, and we've got 12 minutes left. So I would like to get to some public testimony if we could. And I'm going to limit testimony to 3 minutes. And first up is Robin Bronin. Robin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. And so to start off, I want to clarify a couple of the comments that have already been made by Representative Lynn. This is not a simplistic piece of legislation. I have been working here in Alaska at the Alaska Immigration Justice Project since 2005 and have worked with Alaska's immigrant and refugee communities since 1994. I work as an attorney in this state, and immigration law is one of the most complex areas of law, and this legislation makes absolutely no sense in regard to people's immigration status. No one in the United States has an indefinite immigration status except U.S. citizens, and so U.S. citizens would be included in this piece of legislation. I also take note that no one has complained about this issue, and therefore what is the purpose of it except to harm people who we should be most concerned about. And so the rest of my testimony is going to be focused on the work that we do here at the Alaska Immigration Justice Project on behalf of domestic violence victims. I have worked as an attorney with domestic violence victims in Alaska since 1988. I used to work at Alaska Legal Services, where I exclusively worked with domestic violence victims. And here at the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, we work with approximately 250 immigrant victims of violence every year. This legislation would harm them and prevent them from getting necessary ID, which would allow them to leave an abusive relationship. Immigration status is one of the most powerful tools that an abuser can use to prevent a woman from seeking safety and protection. Most of our clients are married to United States citizens who have the responsibility of completing immigration documentation on behalf of their immigrant spouse, and they fail to do so. This legislation would further entrap the hundreds of victims that we work with throughout our state. We work with victims who reside in Unalaska, Barrow, Ketchikan. As you all know, those are communities that are only accessible by plane, Ketchikan by boat, and it would leave them in those communities without protection. Given the fact that the governor is focused this year and for the next several years on turning the curve on ending domestic violence in our state, why would we enact legislation that would further harm domestic violence victims who, through no fault of their own, have been unable to get their immigration documents? Thank you.
Perfect timing. And for the record, it was Robin Bronin. I don't think you said your name for the record.
Sorry. Thank you.
Questions for the testifier? Seeing none. Thank you, Robin. Next up, we'll go to John Hurst.
Hello?
John, are you there? Can you put yourself on the record and give us your testimony?
Okay. My name is John Hurst, and I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom and married to a United States citizen and now a permanent resident of the USA. Last year, I went to the DMV in Anchorage on three separate occasions to get my Alaskan driving license. Each time I went, the staff I spoke to wanted to see my visa for entry into the United States and proof of residence before they would allow me to apply for a license. I did not have a visa or an I-94 as I had entered the U.S. through pre-clearing at Shannon Airport in Ireland, where they're introducing a new scheme of not issuing I-94s for people on visa waiver. The staff at the DMV were not aware of this scheme or indeed seemed to know what proof of my being in the U.S. was acceptable for them to issue me with an Alaskan license. On each occasion, the staff were rude, intimidating, and disrespectful. Under the proposed bill, I would not be allowed an Alaskan driving license, as at that time I had no proof of how long I was to be in the United States, even though I was here perfectly legally. Not having a license would make my chance of employment almost impossible, and my standard of living incredibly difficult, to say the least. In my view, the DMV staff should not be making decisions regarding the legality or length of people's stay in the United States. And lastly, the gentleman who spoke stating that all legal immigrants or visas have a visa is incorrect, as I stated earlier. And he was also wrong, in my experience, that DMV are asking for proof of legally being in the United States before issuing licenses. And I did have to surrender my Washington State driving license to get my Alaskan license. So in my view, nobody would come for a holiday and give up their existing American license for an Alaskan one. Thank you.
John, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Jason Baumitz.
Oh, hi. Good morning, everybody. This is Jason Baumitz. I'm calling today to testify on behalf of myself, although for full disclosure, I am an immigration attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, and I do work at the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, although my testimony is my own. I wanted to express my concern about this bill just because I can't imagine how this bill achieves anything for the people of the state of Alaska. And also, I did have concerns about why burden U.S. citizens and lawful immigrants with yearly renewals. I did look into this statute more deeply after Representative Lynn testified, and but I don't see anything in the text of the statute that limits the yearly renewals to non-immigrants. And I look through all the subsections that that exist. So, and also I do think that the bill miscomprehends the availability of proof of immigration status. There are several immigration statuses where people routinely don't get proof of their status, even though they are lawfully able to remain in the United States. And I don't have the kind of faith, being an immigration practitioner with 8 years of experience, I often get wrong information from the Department of Homeland Security and the USCIS. I don't think it's maliciously wrong, but wrong. And so I don't have the kind of faith that a phone call to USCIS is going to get people always, or even in a majority of the cases, their proof that they are here lawfully. So I have these concerns, and I thank you for letting me express them.
Jason, thank you for your testimony. I see no questions. Okay, in the room, is there anyone else online wanting to testify? Hearing none, we have Jeff Mittman signed up to testify. Jeff, if you could come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska. I thank the committee for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to join in many of the comments of those who have testified previously. As members of the committee know, the ACLU is concerned with constitutional rights and civil liberties, and we review proposed legislation from that perspective. Very briefly, with respect to the idea of burdening immigrants and providing them with a differential license that has less validity or less length of time than that of a U.S. citizen, I would advise the committee that the U.S. Supreme Court and the courts have looked at this issue, and although immigrants are not citizens, they are covered under the Equal Protection Clause of the United States. In certain circumstances, courts will allow differential treatment if there is a justifiable reason. In this case, however, given that you are putting on a lawful immigrant a significant burden in the requirement to have a renewal license, the courts could look askance at this. With somebody who has a definite period of stay, if somebody has a two-year residency and we were to give them a two-year license, a court in New Hampshire, a Fahey decision, I can provide that to the committee, has approved that. However, where there's a quote-unquote indefinite stay, the question is more problematic. Just generally, the reason we make an issue of these concerns is we believe that by protecting the rights of those who are not able to protect their own, and clearly because immigrants cannot vote and they have less political power, we believe by protecting their rights and raising concerns of constitutional treatment we're protecting the rights of all Alaskans. For that reason, and for the reason given by other testifiers, we would request the committee to not pass this bill. With that, I'll be available to answer any questions.
Jeff, thank you for your testimony. Questions by the committee? Okay, we see none. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Hearing none, we have closed public testimony. I ask the bill sponsor to come forward. We'll give you, we've got about 2 minutes. If you could briefly give us any response or any final comments.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My staff here, he's been making copious notes. I think he can respond to some of these questions. Let's start out, first of all, with how many other states have similar legislation?
Through the chair, members of the committee, 30 other states and the District of Columbia already have this provision in current law. It has never been challenged successfully in a federal court on constitutional grounds, so we obviously dispute the ACLU's determination that somehow it's a different situation in Alaska. In addition to the fact that that does provide an incentive for people to It creates a situation where Alaska is one of the states that is more attractive because you can get a blanket five-year license, whereas in the majority of other states and the District of Columbia, it is tied to your length of authorized stay in the country. So I do think that there is some temptation there or that it is an issue that we face. I also just very quickly wanted to address, with the exception of Mr. Mittman, all of the testifiers were speaking about the current situation. Undocumented workers already can't get any sort of license or ID from DMV. People who, what was some of the other things that were raised? Domestic violence and sexual assault, again, if you're undocumented, if that person has used that as a tool against you, DMV is already barred from issuing you a license. And if you do have legal immigration status, there's absolutely nothing in this bill that precludes you from renewing your license. There's nothing that precludes you from getting a license. So I fail to see how this is going to change the current facts on the ground. And then I would also like to address that the concern here is not that someone who is not legally authorized in the United States is going to walk into DMV and get a state-issued license or ID. The concern is that driver's license is for 5 years, and so they would have a state-issued ID that outlasts the federal determination of how long they're allowed to be here. That's the concern, that someone would overstay their authorized length of stay, not that someone who's not authorized to be in the country is walking into DMV right now and getting driver's licenses. We recognize that that's not the situation. Also, I just want to address very quickly that indefinite does not mean indeterminate or in perpetuity. It means duration of status or pending. So, if your immigration status is in dispute or if you still haven't received a determination from Homeland Security but you've been allowed to enter the country legally, whatever documentation you have to show that, Whitney Brewster testified in House State Affairs, DMV would accept. I'm sure we could ask Ms. Hennings to speak to the same thing. And then if you have duration of status, that's, worker visas, student visas, it's tied to your conditions or to your circumstances and not to a specified date. So that's why it's classified as indefinite. But we have spoken with immigration, with the Alaska Contact for Immigration Services. They were not comfortable weighing in on state testimony. However, they did relate to me that they are trying to get away from ever putting the word indefinite on anything and using that term duration of status on all of their documents where it applies. So I just wanted to clear those up for the committee.
Thank you. We're past 10:30. I know members have commitments or meetings. We're going to hold the bill over, obviously, and appreciate you bringing it forward. We will, with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.